For almost as long as Washington has been our center of government, we've had Washington outsiders.
You all think I'm late. Well, I'm not late. And I'm going to stay right here and fight for this lost cause. Even if this room gets filled with lies like these.
These folks are going to shake it up, and they are going to do what's right for America,
okay.
Not necessarily
let me stop.
A political party machine.
The idea of Washington outsiders changing or fixing the broken political system is obviously a theme during this election season. We've had a lot of
Mr. Smith and Ms. Palin there, right?
That's right. Kind of, we're seeing them as sort of tent poles in the Washington outsider landscape, and this isn't the first time candidates have used that sort of anti-incumbent strategy. But what do we know about what happens when these Washington outsiders get inside the Beltway? What do they find there? And do they really have the chance to change Washington as they promised to do? Joining us now is James Marone. He's a political science professor at Brown University and author of The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so clearly the anti-incumbent Washington outsider strategy is old as dirt, isn't it?
Yes, it is. We've seen it past Jimmy Stewart, and we've seen it recently. 1981, a big surge, 12 new Republicans in the Senate. And then, of course, in 1994, during the Clinton midterms, another big Republican surge across the country. And you're going to ask me what they find. You know, two things. On the one hand, they can really shake things up. On the other hand, they are frustrated. It's not as easy as Jimmy Stewart. Let's go with the frustration first, shall we?
Okay.
When the guys get to Washington, the men and women get to Washington, the Congressional Research Service sits them down. I was at this session 2 years ago for the New Democrats, and tells them, here's how you pass a law. That session takes 3 hours. Just here's how you submit a piece of legislation. After 3 hours, they walk out with their eyes glazed, thinking, oh, my God, I can't believe how complicated this is. They're going to find an institution that's built to move like a turtle. So all that screaming and yelling, and all of a sudden you figure, that's what I have to do to pass something? That's pretty tough. So it is a high-bound set of institutions that are pretty tough to move. And there's another thing that every incumbent surge finds. See, there's two parts of the American soul. One part says, we hate government, we're mad as hell. But the second part of the soul says, oh, my God, you're not going to touch that program. If you want small government, you get three programs to really cut. Medicare and Medicaid, oh, that's two maybe. Social Security and the military. And you know what? Americans like all those programs. That gets you to $2.1 trillion. So when they get to Washington, they say, well, for small government, people are going to look around and say, okay, which one of these great sacred cows are you going to take on? And the surge usually picks one, tries to take it on, and gets their heads handed to them. So the job for the leaders are going to be, guys, we know you like change, but go easy on these three biggies, which means make your peace with big government, because that's not going to change.
Okay, but that sounds like you're saying that we were thinking there was a big difference between, say, the experience of Mr. Smith in the movie going to Washington and Sarah Palin if she had ended up as vice president. But that sounds like you're talking about exactly the plot line of the movie. They get to Washington and find out that it's totally tied up in bureaucratic red tape and everything's more complicated than you thought.
Yeah, remember, Jimmy Smith just wanted a summer camp for kids. That's what he was fighting for. That's exactly what they find. When the Gingrich Republicans got to Washington, they thought, we got to make this government smaller, and they decided they were going to cut back on Medicare. And you know what that did? It revived the moribund Clinton presidency. Obama now gets a group of people who are going to be, if they really believe in, we're going to take on and try to change the establishment, they'll be pretty easy pickings.
But there have been radical moments in American history. Andrew Jackson changed Washington. I think it's fair to say that Teddy Roosevelt changed Washington. What did they do right, and what are their lessons for someone that might try to do this? And it sounds like you've said no one really has since, if we're going to go at it in 2010.
it's tougher now because there are such big programs. But you're absolutely right, John. You do get changes, even in the cases that I was saying were so difficult. For starters, you can change the whole tone and attitude in the Capitol. Sometimes that's not all for the best. When the Gingrich people came in, I was talking to one Republican congressman right afterwards. He used to play basketball with Democrats. He always did that. The Gingrich people came in and said, no more of that. We're not going to have you scratch my back, I scratch yours anymore in Washington. They changed the way Congress did business, and it stayed changed. So now the two parties really compete. You might like that, you might not, but they changed the attitudes. Secondly, you can really change the conversation, just the way people think about Washington and think about programs. So if they take a long-run attitude, we're just going to lay our markers down and kind of redefine the conversation. That they can do. You know, Andrew Jackson is a great example. When he was inaugurated, the people got so excited. He threw the White House open for a reception, and so many people jammed in. Jackson's aides had to squeeze him out through a window, or he might have been crushed to death in the mob. That's a great metaphor for how Jackson opened up the conversation in Washington. You didn't have to know someone who knew someone to get into the White House anymore. You had a common man there. And that really changed over time the way Washington did business. So if the new members begin to think, what is it we don't like about the way we do business? Never mind trying to change everything in a day. Let's change the whole tone and conversation little by little, as Jackson did. They might make very radical changes over time.
Until it's time for them to run for re-election, right, James?
Say that again?
Until it's time for them to run for re-election.
Oh, that's right. You've got to remember the American people are schizophrenic about their politics.
Yeah.
They hate government. They love government.
James Marone, political science professor at Brown University, author of The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office. Thanks, James.
Thank you.
And this hour was brought to you by the hard work of our news team, Javier Guzman, Femi Oke, and Maithili Rao. And all hour we've been asking you, because you bring us this hour as well, are people poor because of the choices they make or because of the situations they are born into? Here's an answer.
A more obvious reason is that things are more expensive for poor people, whether it be no transportation, more expensive loans. If they have a bank account, they get gouged by the banks. $35 a transaction that goes overdrawn, etc., etc., etc. The whole system seems to be geared to keeping them in poverty and charging them more for the privilege.
Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. At the other end of the spectrum, if you caught excerpts of my conversation with Google CEO Eric Schmidt, recorded at the MIT Media Lab's 25th anniversary events, and want to hear more, you can listen to the full audio posted at our website, thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headley. So Eric Schmidt, not poor because of choices he made, or...
Well, definitely not poor. He did note that anything that's $1 billion is a good thing, referring to the mobile ad revenue in his last quarter.
I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.